We live in a global era in which what happens thousands of miles away has the ability to affect our lives. This time it is COVID-19, which originated in China. Many had never heard of the place where, but it has certainly spread to the corners of the earth. Next time it could be another infectious disease from somewhere else. This is the new normal of the 21st century. We are connected to this world in all sorts of ways. So, according to our next guest, we need to better understand it, both its promise and its threats. The new book is The World, A Brief Introduction. It is by Dr. Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. He served as the senior Middle East advisor to President George H.W. Bush, as director of the policy planning staff under Secretary of State Colin Powell, and as the U.S. envoy to both the Cyprus and Northern Ireland peace talks. We welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Dr. Haass, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
What brought you to want to really take on the world, if you will, to introduce us to this world as we are living in it now?
Well, 36,000 feet, I would say, I was simply struck by the gap between how important the world is to our lives. And this is brought home, obviously, by the pandemic, which happened after I wrote the book, but by 9/11. By any number of financial crises, by climate change, by wars, you name it, and how little most Americans know about this world that will so fundamentally shape their lives. The immediate story was one where I met this college person about to become a senior, and he was a computer sciences major at Stanford, and I started asking questions about what he studied outside of computers, and what quickly emerged was virtually nothing, that he was going to graduate from one of the elite institutions in the world and really not even have the basics about the world or about economics or about history. And then the more I looked into it, I realized this was not an exception, that you could graduate from virtually any high school or any college or university in this country. And if you navigated what courses were offered in a certain way, you could manage to be essentially illiterate about the world that you were going to enter. And I just said, if that's true of young people, it's also going to be true of older people. Nightly news doesn't help you very much anymore. So I essentially set out to write a book that was going to be short, relatively short, would not require all sorts of background or previous expertise, that would basically say, here's what you need to know. Here's a foundation. Here's how to make sense of all that's coming at you to help you navigate the news. And my goal was to essentially try to help many citizens become better informed. And that way they could make better decisions, whether who they voted for and so forth. But they could also make better decisions in terms of their personal lives, how to invest, what to do about business, what kind of careers to take. So that's essentially what inspired the book.
I want to get into the meat of the book in just a second, but why do you think we so often don't know more? I mean, I guess another way to ask this question is, why do we not learn from history and or our mistakes?
Well, that's one I scratch my head on, too. I think the United States has a tradition of isolationism. There's also this whole idea of American exceptionalism. So we're often, we see ourselves somehow operating outside history, that we're special. And yes, we are special in some ways, obviously, and different, but we don't operate outside history. We tend to turn off things that we don't like. So we've had some bad experiences in the world, and we prefer not to dwell on them or learn from them. We're a continent, so there's plenty to keep us busy here. So I think there's any number of reasons that we tend not to look at history. The whole idea of the United States was to create a country that wasn't going to be held back by the lessons of history. And being a continental country, we were separate from a lot of the world. And I think these traditions run powerfully through the veins of American politics. And the problem is they don't apply to a global world where nothing stays local for long. As you said, what begins in Wuhan doesn't stay there. Borders are not impermeable. Oceans are not moats. We're vulnerable. So our instincts in many ways are at odds with the realities of this world we find ourselves in.
When it comes to those realities, what do we know about globalization and the challenges that it presents?
What we know about globalization is that all sorts of stuff, to use a decidedly untechnical word, from computer viruses to real viruses to dollar bills to people to guns to drugs to ideas to virtually anything and everything. Greenhouse gases crosses borders at enormous speed in tremendous volume. And this is a reality. And governments, in some cases, are powerless to do much about it. And in some cases, though, they have quite a lot of decisions to make. So I would say globalization is one of the, if not the, defining reality of this era of history. And what we have to decide is what is how we're going to respond to it. We have a whole range of choices. I would simply say the choice of ignoring it is a fatal mistake, and that we're paying for it to some extent now. We're paying for it with climate change, and trying to think we can handle it on our own is also a major strategic mistake. We need to pay attention to it. We need partners to deal effectively with it, but the specific policies we choose to embrace, well, that's worthy of a serious conversation.
So I had always intended not to make this an overtly political conversation, but I let me ask a question as an example, which is when this country decides, okay, we're in a pandemic, and the leadership says, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to go it alone when it comes to a vaccine. Well, what is the effect? So let's just use as an example of that thinking, not maybe of the actual event, but of that thinking, that the advantage of that to us and what it says to the rest of the world.
Look, it's a big mistake in lots of ways in the specifics. I think it slows down the search for a vaccine, or could slow it down. It means if, by the way, this international effort led by the Europeans ever bears fruit, it's going to be very hard for us to say we should be at the front of the queue if we weren't there. If you're not there on the takeoff, you can't expect to be there on the landing. Right. I think more broadly, though, it doesn't come out of nowhere. This is an administration that has dropped out of more international agreements than I can count. This is an administration that is regularly attacked its traditional partners, its allies. This is an agreement that tends not to like international institutions because they see them as somehow tying its hands. So what I think the pandemic does is reinforces this administration's instincts against internationalism, against international involvement, and also reinforces its instincts towards unilateralism. But I think what it also does is it shows the costs and the limits of that approach to the world. Again, I just think that isolationism is a dead end, and thinking we can do it better by ourselves, it's just simply there's no historical support for that assessment.
And the idea of what it does to our place in the rest of the world, and how, even if there is a change in administration, of how that is, of how that works, you know, of how you get out of that, for want of a better term, of that reputation.
No, we are taking a reputational hit for two reasons. One is what we've just talked about, the fact that we've opted out of so many international undertakings. And for 70 years, the United States was the principal leader of most of the productive international undertakings in the world. We, by the way, benefited from that tremendously. So now we've opted out. The other thing is we've also lost out tremendously in terms of the example we've set. People forget that often the most important thing in foreign policy is not simply what diplomats like I used to be would say or soldiers do, but it's the example you set, your economy, your how well your politics work, and so forth. And now, by the dysfunction of our politics, by our often, I would use the word inept response to the pandemic, we have set an example that no one around the world will want to emulate, and it simply diminishes respect for the United States. So both by our foreign policy and by our domestic reality, I believe we are working against we're working against our own influence.
This, you know, that if you look at this book of sort of international affairs 101, you wonder why aren't we taught this more often?
I asked the same question myself, and there's no consensus in the United States about what ought to be taught. certainly at the high school level, every state is different. You know, national standards or national curriculum, a common core curriculum, a common core, is it's like a lightning rod for debate. I find that bizarre that we don't expect every American of a certain age to know certain things. How do we expect our political DNA to be transmitted to the next generation? K through 10 education until we're 16 is the one thing we know every American experiences. After that, there's a degree of optionality. When you finish high school, whether you go to college, what do you do for the rest of your life? So the fact that we don't take more advantage of those years when we know people are in school to make sure they understand the tradition of our country, they understand the basics of the world, but they obviously need to learn the, you know, the essential, you know, educational and intellectual skills. But I think there's no agreement on it, so it's very hard to get agreement on what should be taught. Everybody has their own idea about the priorities, but we end up as a result with either 50 different answers in each of the states, and there's no commonality. Again, the idea that you I say one other thing. I think consumers ought to be more demanding. We pay the taxes by which public schools are funded. By definition, if you send children to private schools or private universities, you're paying fees. I don't understand why individuals and parents and the rest are not more involved on demanding what it is their son or daughter learns before he or she gets a degree. I would think in one of my goals for writing the book is to get parents and individuals to think about education, one, to be more demanding of it. What is it I learned in high school or college? And then I also want people to think of education as a lifelong activity. So even if you didn't get it in high school, didn't get it in college, it's not too late. You've got the next 50 years to get it. And one way, and the reason I wrote this book is it's not to provide all the answers, but it's to provide something of a foundation.
It does seem, though, that the book does seem to predict that this global disorder will accelerate.
It does. I admit that my default option is a little bit negative, and the reason is that without the United States playing a large role, I don't see the world coming together by itself. You've got a lot of trends going on. You've got a rising China. You've got a really angry, still Russia. You've got a North Korea with a growing nuclear inventory. You've got Iran pushing back against its neighbors. And then on top of all that, you've got all these global issues that are only getting worse with the passage of time. And good things just don't happen in history. It's a little bit like high school science when you study this idea of randomness or entropy. Systems don't come together by themselves. The natural tendency of things is to come apart. And so unless, in particular, the United States is willing to lead, not do it by itself, but lead, the last 75 years of history suggest that good things cannot be expected to happen. Now, the last 75 years also showed that the United States, if it does lead, can bring about great things, and we could do it at a manageable cost. The benefits are greater than the cost. So I think there's a powerful case for the United States rejecting isolationism, for rejecting unilateralism. But these lessons seem to have been lost. So one of the reasons I decided to write this book was to essentially once again make the case for American involvement in the world.
You were just about out of time, but I want to make this case because you do it so well in the book. One of the keys here, really, one of my takeaways in reading this, but one of the keys here is for things to go right, we have to have a shared sacrifice. We don't, and I mean we, this country, but we, the world, don't seem to be very good at that idea, right, of a shared sacrifice.
No, and right now we have some common sacrifices in terms of this pandemic, but that, I wouldn't say it's a shared sacrifice. And I think there's an argument to be made that we ought to come together, not simply as acts of goodwill towards our fellow man, not simply as acts of philanthropy, but as enlightened self-interest. The only way we're going to make things better here at home and for Americans, if things get better in the world, that ought to be the principal lesson of the pandemic. Again, bad things happening in Wuhan, China, or 20 years ago, bad things happening in a remote corner of Afghanistan, which led to 9/11. bad things can happen elsewhere that can become even worse here. And that ought to be, to me, a principal takeaway.
But I took shared sacrifices also to mean concessions, that we have to concede certain things. We may want it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But right? Yeah. But for the betterment of our world, you have to say, okay, we have to give in on this.
Well, absolutely. Look, compromise is not a dirty word. In any political negotiation, whether it's personal, domestic, international, there's always compromises. You never get 100%. The question is, are you better off with an agreement than without it? And if you're not better off, if there are better alternatives, then you take those. But in many instances, you will be better off, even though you don't get 100% of what it is you want. You can't measure the achievable against the ideal. You got to measure the achievable against the alternatives.
The name of the book is The World, A Brief Introduction. Dr. Richard Haass, I thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on our program.
Thanks, sir. You take care of yourself. Stay healthy.
Be well. You too. Thank you very much. Again, Dr. Richard Haass is the author of The World. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.